From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm your host, Roger McDonough. Today on the program, we're going to have a conversation with Dr. John Carlquist, a member of a team of researchers from the Intermountain Medical Center, who say they've discovered genetic markers that may predict when people with heart disease are likely to have a heart attack. We'll talk about their discovery and its potential implications for the field of heart medicine.
It gives us an idea that we can follow up on, that there are processes occurring that are leading to a heart attack, and we actually can maybe drill down on those and gain further information.
That conversation, your summary of the day's top local headlines, as well as a look at a new no-kill initiative by Utah Animal Shelters, just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. First up, though, these messages and access downtown. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up later on the show, we're going to have a conversation about a new discovery by a team of Utah researchers that may have big implications for people with heart disease. But first up, we have these headlines. A group in Utah is trying to turn all animal shelters in the state into so-called no-kill shelters. The No-Kill Utah campaign kicked off at the Leonardo on Sunday, and they hope to achieve their goal by 2019. For more, here's KCPW's Ryan Cunningham.
In 2000, according to the Best Friends Animal Society, over 46,000 dogs and cats died in Utah animal shelters. But thanks largely to the No More Homeless Pets in Utah coalition, that number was down 71.5% in 2013 to 18,000 cats and dogs. Still, Best Friends estimates that 12,000 of those deaths could have been prevented. That's why Best Friends has announced the launch of a new initiative called No-Kill Utah. The goal is to get every animal shelter in Utah to be a no-kill shelter by 2019. No-kill means that 90% of the animals taken in by a shelter leave alive. That's the goal that the Salt Lake County shelter achieved last year.
For 2013, we were at a 91.5% live release rate. So that's the first time in our history that we've had the year average be that.
That's Sandy Nelson of the Salt Lake County Animal Services. She says that Salt Lake County decided to go no-kill back in 2009 and says that the decision was part of a shift in thinking about how animal shelters should be managed.
In the past, shelters have just been a place for stray animals. And it just took a shift in thinking of going, you know what, we can achieve this, and this is something that's very doable. We take in between 7,000 and 9,000 animals per year. That's a lot of animals. Just to think about the sheer number of adopting that many animals out, it became very important to our shelter and to our community, and we said, let's do this. You know, let's stop the endless killing of healthy and adoptable animals within shelters. I mean, there's no point of needing to euthanize due to space.
To achieve the no-kill goal statewide by 2019, Tema Martin of No-Kill Utah says the initiative will be advocating for a lot of the same tactics that have brought the mortality rate down in recent years. But the campaign's success will rely heavily on the awareness and support of Utah citizens.
What we need people to do if they believe in, you know, making Utah the largest and only second in the nation no-kill state is to make good decisions about their pets and to encourage others to do the same. And that means when somebody's looking for a new pet for the family, we ask people to choose to adopt from a shelter or a rescue group rather than buying from a pet store or a breeder or an online retailer, because choosing to adopt, you're literally saving a life and you're reducing the demand for businesses that either produce more animals or, you know, ship animals in from puppy mills in the Midwest, for example.
Martin says many people are concerned about how animals are treated in shelters, which is key for the movement. But many people may not be aware of the scope of the problem.
We actually did a study, not just in Utah, but a national survey to find out what people know about this issue of animal homelessness. And in fact, nationally, 9,000 animals die in shelters every day, and the majority of people that we surveyed thought the number was closer to 500 a day nationally. So we don't believe that people don't care. We believe that people aren't familiar with how big this problem still is.
Nelson, who attended No-Kill Utah's launch event on Sunday, is encouraged by the interest and enthusiasm shared by members of the Utah community, and she believes the goal is very doable.
So it doesn't happen overnight, and it needs to start with just easy baby steps. So starting, number one, getting your shelter behind the no-kill movement, getting your community behind the no-kill movement, and just starting down the path. Because I believe once you say it, and once your community knows that's what you are striving to achieve, then they're going to get behind that and help and do what they can to help their community have a no-kill shelter.
Currently, New Hampshire is the only state to be no-kill statewide. In Utah, Washington County, Salt Lake County, and the West Valley City Taylorsville shelters have earned no-kill status. For KCPW News, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
A practice known as revenge pornography, where people try to humiliate former romantic partners by sharing sexually explicit images of them, is now a criminal offense in the state of Utah. Governor Gary Herbert on Monday signed legislation making it a misdemeanor the first time someone shares the images without the person's consent. Repeat offenses would be a felony. Salt Lake City Democratic Representative Marie Polson pushed for the law during this year's legislative session. She says the practice most often targets women and can cause some to lose their jobs. Two states have passed similar laws, and at least 22 other states have considered similar measures this year. And finally today, Utah healthcare advocates are working to help people enroll in insurance and navigate the sometimes buggy online marketplace. On Monday, the deadline date for signing up. Utah consumers shopping on the federally run online marketplace ran up against website problems for hours on Monday morning. Federal officials said the website was up and working by 7 a.m. Utah time, but local groups helping consumers enroll reported problems into the mid-morning. Jason Stevenson with the Utah Health Policy Project said consumers were still able to set up accounts and shop for plans, but that they weren't able to purchase them. The marketplace, a hallmark of President Barack Obama's health care overhaul, allows people a place to compare insurance plans and sign up for coverage. Most Americans are required to have health insurance this year under the law, and today is the deadline to get covered. And that does it for our summary of the day's top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. Stay with us. And now on the program, we're going to look at a new study whose results could revolutionize the way we treat heart health in coming years. Researchers from the Intermountain Medical Center announced on Sunday that they have discovered genetic markers that may predict when people with heart disease are likely to have a heart attack. And you could imagine the potential impact for the more than 720,000 Americans who suffer a heart attack in a given year. To learn more, I'm joined now by Dr. John Carlquist, a member of the team that made the discovery. Dr. Carlquist, thanks very much for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Roger. It's nice to be here.
So I was hoping we could start with the basic facts. Could you explain what it was that you and your team discovered?
Well, what we were hoping to find, and the way we embarked on this study was looking at blood samples that we'd drawn from individuals with different forms of heart disease over a period of about 20 years. We've been collecting samples for about 20 years. Individuals who do have certain forms of heart disease come in periodically, and we collect blood from them. Mm-hmm. And we store that. And our thinking was, with that many samples, about 30,000 now, were we able to collect any of those surrounding the time when a person actually had a heart attack? Mm-hmm. And our hope was we could find some of those and actually look at some markers to get an idea what the processes are that are just preceding that heart attack. Are there any signals that we can actually identify which might indicate that person is moving toward a heart attack? And so we went through our samples, we went through our database, and we found at that time about 40, maybe it was 44 samples that were collected within a period of, 3 weeks or so before a person actually had a heart attack. And then we went back and looked at a variety of markers to see what we could find, and two actually stood out. They're microRNAs, 122 and 126. The levels of those, which compared to normal individuals, were decreased.
It was a sudden drop in these microRNAs. I think we're going to have to explain to our listeners what microRNA is. It's different from regular messenger RNA. What is it? What is its function?
Right. Well, you know, all the cells in our body function with a whole array of on-off switches, and microRNAs are an off switch, and so they tend to downregulate and regulate certain functions of the cell when they're operating normally. So when one of these decreases in its level, what that means is that the things it was regulating, kind of being a watchdog, are now unregulated and can take off without any kind of checks and balances. So what that seems to be indicating is that something, some process is going on which is normally held in check, but no longer is.
Well, and that's fascinating. In this example, what's being held in check is the heart attack itself. So the study was conducted by finding these samples that came within a certain period of time of a person having a heart attack. How common was that? I mean, you said you found how many samples in total of people who had been within that?
Well,
row?
It was actually a very small number. It was in the range of 40 samples. But you've got to understand that it was actually very fortuitous that we just found these 40 samples, that we actually collected them, not knowing an individual is going to have a heart attack.
Right, because currently you can't predict when a heart attack is going to happen, or I guess these results from your study wouldn't matter.
And I think that's the really unique thing about this study, and it's the unique thing about our DNA bank, is that we have just these randomly collected samples, and we were able to find some that were just fortuitously randomly collected within a few days before a person had a heart attack.
Wow. What does this mean practically? At first, at least, I guess you would think that predicting heart attacks can prevent a lot of the damage that heart attacks cause, because you could conceivably hospitalize somebody in advance of their heart attacks. Is that sort of the hope with this research?
Well, I think that's a possibility. I think that's maybe stretching it just a little bit. What we were really hoping for, and the reason we actually studied this, is we were trying to learn more about the processes that lead to a heart attack. To use this as a test to predict when someone's going to have a heart attack is a little bit impractical, because you'd have to be testing people essentially all the time and to see if the signal is actually developing.
Well, you know, you think about people who have who are diabetic, for example, and have pretty constantly testing their blood sugar. So maybe it's a long ways down the line, but could this eventually lead to, maybe if you have heart disease, you carry around some sort of kit and you do a daily test to see whether or not you are, if a heart attack is imminent. Is that a possibility?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think that's probably not as far in the future as we may think. I mean, with nanotechnology and, you know, the apps that now exist on our phones, you could actually plug into something like that and be constantly monitored, and you could actually get an alert should the levels of your microRNA change.
It was almost as though you planned that sound effect right there. That's pretty good. Another question I have is, beyond that potential test and the benefits that would obviously be associated with that if that did happen, is there the possibility of, say, finding a way to prevent the heart attack from occurring at all by somehow addressing this drop in microRNA 122 and 126?
Right. And that's, like I say, that I think that's what we were actually hoping to look at. That's what we were hoping to find. Many people, probably half the population, develops coronary disease. And some of those go on to have a heart attack and some do not. Mm-hmm. And so what is the process that leads someone to a heart attack, and why do they remain stable? And that was our intent. That was what we were hoping to find. Some kind of a window or a key indicator that suggests that this process is occurring in some people but not in others.
How big of a discovery? I mean, you're kind of a tough one to ask this to, because you're close to the what's happened, but how big of a discovery is this?
Well, you know, actually, microRNAs now are just being studied rampantly. Really, everyone is looking at those, especially in cancer and a lot of different pathological processes. And in terms of heart disease, I mean, hundreds of microRNAs have been studied now. So in one sense, it's not a really big discovery. In another sense, it sort of is, because it tells us maybe this isn't on its own earth-shaking, but it gives us an idea that we can follow up on, that there are processes occurring that are leading to a heart attack, and we actually can maybe drill down on those and gain further information. So in one sense, it's a big discovery. In another sense, it's not so big.
What happens next with this research? I mean, now that this has been discovered, is it kind of released to the wider research field, and people begin to do their own work on it? Or what happens next?
Oh, yeah. Typically, that will be what happens. The follow-up, other people who are working in the same area will probably try to replicate this or extend it in some way. MicroRNAs, like one microRNA, will regulate an entire family of genes. So the question now is, what is being regulated by that microRNA that is no longer is becoming, in other words, dysregulated once the drop occurs? So I think that's something that we want to know next.
Who all was involved in the study? Was it just the Intermountain Medical Center's research team?
Actually, it was. As I mentioned earlier, we started this about 20 years ago. We started saving DNA, getting consent from patients and enrolling them in the study and saving DNA, and trying to correlate biomarkers, genetic changes in those samples with their clinical course. And over the 20 years, like I mentioned, we have about 30,000 of these samples. And so that represents an amazing resource. And I think that this particular study speaks to the value of that resource. At that time, Dr. Jeff Anderson was a primary mover. I was involved in that. Dr. Brent Muehlstein as well. This study that we're talking about was actually conducted in my lab by Dr. Oksana Galenko, who's now back in Washington presenting these results at the American College of Cardiology meetings. And that's principally the team that's been involved.
You know, you talk about the voluntary DNA bank that, you know, patients had given consent to. Are there a lot of researchers around the country who have similar sized DNA banks?
Not of this particular phenotype, not of coronary disease like we have. People are getting on the bandwagon everywhere. I think this is becoming very, very popular. And looking at massive quantities of data and genetic markers is now a real, it's the forefront of research in a lot of pathogenic processes, heart disease as well as cancer and rheumatic disease, all kinds of things. I mean, I think this is the way we're kind of looking at how can we coalesce all this data, both genetic and clinical, and come up with some answers.
You know, it sounds like the study must have involved a lot of computer modeling because what you're looking at is a lot of overlapping groups and then trying to, first to eliminate a big chunk of people who hadn't had their blood drawn just before they had a heart attack, but then also trying to figure out which factors might be similar in that group that wouldn't be present in a healthy population. I suppose what I mean is that it sounds a lot like the analysis would require a complex statistical model or something, or not statistical, but computer model. Is that basically what you were...
It is, and I'm not, that's not my area of expertise at all. We have a number of analysts who do the data analysis. They're very good at statistical modeling, and they can actually look at these in combination with other variables and come up with risk models. This is a little bit afield from what we're talking about, but this is something we do a lot. We take different markers, different variables, and create risk models.
Finally, I'm curious about if there's the potential of doing this with other diseases, if you can use this database that you have to try and extrapolate information about other diseases.
Well, cancer was probably the foremost disease studied with microRNAs. I think most of the literature, most of the data in the literature surrounds cancer and microRNAs. Heart disease was a little later into the arena, but it's catching up. It's catching up.
How many people are at risk of heart attack in the United States of America or in Utah?
What are the numbers? It seems like roughly half of us are going to die from some form of heart disease, whether that's heart failure in old age or coronary disease, heart attack. So it's a prevalent problem. It really is.
I'd like to get clarification one more time on the potential practical uses resulting from this study. Let's say that you can have a blood test and predict that you, as somebody who has heart disease, is going to have a heart attack within a certain amount of time, within days, for example, or hours, you might not know. What would be the kind of treatment application then? Would you just immediately hospitalize that person? Is that the idea? And say, all right, we've got to keep this person here until they have that heart attack and then treat the heart attack as it happens?
Well, that's an excellent question, but I think it goes back to what we talked about a few moments ago. Once we understand what that process is, then we can develop interventions. Presently, what we know about those microRNAs isn't sufficient to allow us to actually develop a reasonable intervention. Perhaps the interventions we have now would be adequate, but my hope is, and my belief, that as we understand more about this process, we can specifically tailor interventions to prevent that event from occurring.
Dr. John Carlquist is a researcher at the Intermountain Medical Center's Heart Institute. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Roger.
And you can find this interview as well as all of the past conversations we've had on the program at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're tuned into The Rundown. We'll be right back. And thanks once more for tuning in to The Rundown. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be speaking with New York Times Supreme Court correspondent Adam Liptak about the judicial history of same-sex marriage in America. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.